materials.
I'm so glad so I
are two zombies.
Oh, so no, it's...
I feel like we could have done a better job.
Did you?
I think we got it wrong. I think Commissioner Fish wanted the cameras
facing
this
way.
It's only a little bit.
Thank you.
Well, I made sure to put the like aluminum lid or something over the top.
So funny. I'm like, how did I get that from Michael? I just left a bunch of...
I did not.
Have you been in a yoga retreat lately?
No, but I am on the verge of taking a 2-month sabbatical.
Really?
October, November, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So excited to travel.
So Sheila got the boat.
I'm going to spend 5 of the weeks in Cape Cod.
That's a nice place.
Yeah.
Yes.
Are you from there?
I was born in Brooklyn, but I've actually never been. Oh, I'm going to be in Provincetown, but I've never been.
Yeah. You're a Brooklynite, huh?
Yeah.
That's where my daughter lives now.
Oh, yeah? She was in California for a while?
Yeah.
Okay.
She lives in Brooklyn. She started grad school at St. John's.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going out there in a couple weeks to visit. Yeah, and I've gone a few times and stayed in Brooklyn. It's nice. I mean, Brooklyn's a great place.
Yeah, it is. So she enjoyed
every time
it.
I've always gone to New York, it's always been to stay in Manhattan. Yeah.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon, Commissioner Fish.
Yeah, quite different from
good afternoon, everybody. Welcome. This is the September 11th, 2018 work session. Welcome to the Joint Office on Homeless Services work session. Today we're going to be discussing the Joint Office's outcomes, their report for the 2018 fiscal year. We have a shorter timeline than usual for that presentation, but I'm looking forward to hearing about the results of the investments that we've made over the past year. The focus, of course, for the rest of today's session is going to be on our progress towards 2,000 units of supportive housing, which is significant. Supportive housing is often the most effective way to serve a significant share of our neighbors experiencing homelessness. Supportive housing is humane and cost-effective compared to the expense of hospital and jail beds. It's also the most sustainable solution to address the livability challenges that come when people in crisis must live their private lives in public. We're also going to be making later on an exciting and I think a very important announcement regarding the housing bond. And before we jump into those things, I'm going to let the chair speak. But before we do that, why don't we also just quickly go around the table? I'm not sure everybody knows everybody. So if we could just go ahead and go around the table and do quick introductions.
Sure, absolutely.
Thank you.
My name is Heather Lyons. I'm with the Corporation.
I'm Mark Jolin with the Joint Office of Homeless Services.
Patricia Rojas, Deputy Director, Joint Office Homeless Services.
Sharon Myron, Multnomah County Commissioner for District 1.
Nick Fish, Portland City Commissioner, and I have a question for Carla, our clerk, which is, do you want us to turn these off when we speak, after we speak?
I think you're okay leaving them on.
So that's new. Okay.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Good afternoon. Lori Stegman, Multnomah County Commissioner for District 4, representing East County.
Deborah Kefori, Multnomah County Chair.
Ted Wheeler, Mayor.
Chloe Daly, Portland City Commissioner.
Jessica Vega Peterson, Multnomah County Commissioner for District 3.
Dan Saltzman, Portland City Commissioner.
Michael Bonacore, Home Forward.
Shannon Callahan, the Portland Housing Bureau.
Very good. So before we jump in, I'd like to have Chair Kefori make some opening remarks.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor Wheeler and the Portland City Council, for hosting today's joint city-county work session. It really fills me with pride to sit here looking at my colleagues from both sides of our wonderful community. The housing crisis was our call to action, and our collective response was swift, culminating in the creation of the Joint Office of Homeless Services. It's been 2 years since we embarked on this journey together. We stepped into uncharted territory, and we bound ourselves together with one vision of ending homelessness. As you will see today, our coordinated and data-driven approach has made great strides, and we have momentum, and it is crucial that we keep it going. Because we can't forget that while it was the Great Recession that sparked this crisis, it is the economic recovery that has made it permanent. We hear that unemployment levels are going down, 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 but that isn't much to celebrate when you're working three jobs to keep the rent. And it's no surprise that the number of people experiencing homelessness on the West Coast is a result of skyrocketing rents and lower incomes. If you're poor, you are the first to be hit by an economic downturn. But even in the boom times, you're still hit hard. We live in an economy that is defined by income inequality. So for as long as income inequality defines our country's economic system, the Joint Office will remain a necessary local model for communities across the nation. Today's presentation will remind us of how far we've come in two short years, the homes we've saved, the homes we've created, and the next steps we will need to secure 2,000 units of supportive housing.
Very good. So with that, we'll turn it over to Mark Jolin, who is the outstanding leader of the Joint Office of Homeless Services for Multnomah County in the city of Portland. He's going to update us on the progress, in many cases record-setting progress over the last year. Good afternoon, Mark.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having us. As the chair said, we celebrated our second birthday on July 1st, and one of our commitments has been to come before you in this joint session once a year to update you on the progress that we've been making. As the mayor said, we have a shorter amount of time today than we have in past years to talk specifically about the work of the joint office, and so we'll have to do some follow-up afterwards because we really want to save time for the presentation of the supportive housing report and the progress update that the mayor was talking about. That said, we do want to give you an overview both of some of the work that's been happening in the office and some of the outcomes. So the Joint Office was founded as part of the Home for Everyone plan, which called for the creation of a new lead agency on homelessness in our community and out of the urgent need to ensure that we are making the best possible investments of city and county resources in the face of the housing and homelessness crisis. Our work continues to be guided by the vision, core values, and strategies of this plan, the first being prioritizing the most vulnerable populations. This year, we advanced that value by fully implementing coordinated access to supportive housing in our community. We've assessed over 1,500 people and prioritized them for supportive housing based on their vulnerability. We prioritize racial and ethnic justice. That's been a particularly central focus of our work this year. We supported the members of A Home for Everyone in chartering an official equity committee. We joined seven other cities nationally as part of the Supporting Partnerships for Anti-Racist Communities, or SPARC, initiative, which will have us looking deeply into the ways that institutional and structural racism cause homelessness and developing specific strategies to address that racism through our programming. We also just closed the recruitment for a new equity manager in our office that will be supporting the racial equity work within A Home for Everyone and among our nonprofit providers. We use data-driven assessment and accountability. This was an area that was called out in a report last year by the county auditor as really needing to be a focus for our office in order to ensure long-term success, and I couldn't agree more. In partnership with the Portland Housing Bureau and the Department of County Human Services, we've been working hard this year to improve data quality and our capacity to pull, analyze, and report data on a timely basis. You'll see just a glimpse of that today, but a lot more in the future. In addition to the strengthened coordination around data, we've added a data analyst to our team who has already significantly increased our ability to use data to monitor and evaluate our systems and programs. We engage and involve the community in all aspects of our strategies to address homelessness. It's one of the Joint Office's core functions to support the Home for Everyone governance structure, and that's significant. The Executive Committee, the Coordinating Board, multiple policy subcommittees, the Equity Committee, the Data Quality Committees, and various population-specific oversight groups. These forums literally engage hundreds of people from a broad range of stakeholder communities and a significant number of people with lived experience of homelessness. And finally, we strengthen system capacity and increase leverage opportunities. This was another critical focus of our second year, and frankly, it's one of the promises of the Joint Office that is most important to us. We did increase our investments in the capacity of our nonprofits. We also initiated a number of really significant partnerships that align our efforts, the joint office's efforts, with the county health department, with city and county emergency management, with the Office of Civic Life, with Home Forward, with the Portland Police Bureau and OMF, with faith and business community leaders, and with the Portland Housing Bureau on a number of supportive housing projects that you're going to hear more about. Formation of the Joint Office of Homeless Services was intended to bring better coordination, integration, and consistency to the delivery of homeless services in our community. Our goal has been to integrate the best of the tremendous work that was happening at PHB and DCHS. As you can see on this slide, homeless services continue to be organized by population groups. Adult-only households, youth under the age of 24, families with children, and domestic violence survivors. We also have a subsystem for homeless veterans. While serving different populations, all of these systems share certain common values and approaches. All include culturally specific services and an expectation that every organization is delivering culturally responsive services. All the systems use an assertive engagement service delivery model, a model that recognizes that people are the experts in their own lives, emphasizes the central role of authentic relationships in successful service delivery, and integrates best practices like trauma-informed care and motivational interviewing. All of our systems are continuously evaluating and improving. Each population system has an oversight body or leadership group that meets regularly to assess system design, evaluate outcomes, and pursue quality improvement. And each nonprofit provider that we fund is held accountable through their contracts for specific outcomes and provides quarterly reports to the joint office. Finally, every one of these systems is re-procured at least every 5 years. When we were initially formed, we participated in the re-procurement of the domestic violence system. This past year, we led the re-procurement of all family homeless services in our community, and right now we have an RFPQ, a request for proposals or qualifications, open for all of the services to homeless adults without children. These re-procurements are exciting opportunities to welcome new organizations who can contract with the joint office. Each of these systems also contains the same integrated core elements, and this is what you see in the circle here, in these circles. And I'm not going to go through all of them, but I do want to pull out a couple that relate to the outcome measures you're going to see in a moment. As you've often heard us say, the three core strategies to ending homelessness are prevention, placement back into permanent housing, and shelter that provides the basic safety and support services that make it a platform for returning to permanent housing. All of our systems feature these three elements. Prevention for those who have not yet become homeless, but without an intervention may become homeless. While the joint office does some of this work ourselves, a lot of it is done through Department of County Human Services, family stabilization programs, and increasingly by the Portland Housing Bureau's tenant protection efforts. Housing placement and retention, this involves people moving out of shelter, off the streets, or out of dangerously doubled up situations, back into permanent housing. It also involves the support services that they need to retain that housing. We have both short-term interventions that we call rapid rehousing, where we're providing limited rent assistance, limited housing case management, and also supportive housing programs like the ones we'll talk about today, where there's long-term, deeply affordable rent, long-term wraparound support services. And of course, in each of these systems, we have emergency shelter. We have our long-standing shelter and the many shelter beds that you know we've opened over the last several years. You also know that in this past year, we've transitioned from the rapid expansion of shelter beds to improving the quality of all of our shelter beds and better embedding services in those shelters so that we can maximize the number of people who are able to transition through them and back into housing. In each of these systems, we also have commitments to employment and benefit services, healthcare supports, and very importantly, information and access that is equitable into these services so people can get to them and get to them fairly. These are the key integrated elements that allow services in this community to be provided in an equitable, effective, and efficient manner. Our budget, which many of you are familiar with, largely reflects this allocation of different types of work across our different systems. The chart also illustrates the balance that we try to strike between investments in shelter operations and investments in helping people get back into housing and stay in housing. You'll also see here that about 4% of our budget goes to staff in the office to administer the systems of care and to support the Home for Everyone initiative. We're approaching 21 FTE this year. We've hired a new deputy director. as well as a data analyst. We are hiring an equity manager and a new emergency management specialist to help ensure that we can meet our commitments to the community and to our providers. So I'm going to pause here for a minute, and I want to thank very sincerely the amazing staff at the Joint Office. This is a group of people who have been tireless for the past 2 years. It takes a lot to change work groups or even employers to help build a new office and also be expanding the capacity of the systems dramatically and ensuring that that expansion is happening in an intentional and effective and accountable way. So if you're here with the Joint Office, can you just raise your hands for a minute and be acknowledged? I know many of you are here. And I also want to thank all of the staff of other city bureaus and county departments who have partnered with us to help build a solid foundation for the Joint Office. We could not have done it without them. I in particular want to acknowledge the Portland Housing Bureau staff and the Department of County Human Services staff who've been there with us every step of the way, are in our office every day making this work. And so thank you all very much for that. We are investing a significant sum of money, as you saw in our budget slide, in this work. This slide is intended to illustrate, however, that we are serving a lot of people with those investments. And when we break down the cost, it's actually not that significant on a per-person basis. What you see here is the total number of placements into emergency shelter done last year divided into the total amount of money spent on emergency shelter operations. It gets to a $2,197 per person cost. Similarly, when we divide the total number of people helped with housing placement and retention assistance last year into our budget, it's $2,423 per person that we're investing. When you consider what those investments mean to the people whose lives we're touching and what the alternative cost would be if we weren't making these investments, these are modest investments. The other thing that's important, I think, to call out here is we often talk about how much more effective it is to provide permanent housing than to provide shelter. And what you see here is a pretty modest difference in what it costs to provide shelter to someone as opposed to permanent housing. So if we can find permanent housing, we want to provide it to folks. And finally, before I turn it over to Patricia to talk about the actual outcome data, as much good as you're about to hear about, and there has been a lot to celebrate in the work this past year, the work of the Joint Office continues to happen in an incredibly challenging environment for our lowest income and most vulnerable people. What you see here is an illustration of, for example, the 20,000 people in our community who have SSI as their income. They have less than $800 a month in their earnings. The yellow bar is the amount of money they should be contributing to their rent. The bars on the right are what the costs of an average studio apartment, one-bedroom apartment, and two-bedroom apartment actually are. Not only is it not affordable for someone on SSI, but it's impossible for someone on SSI to afford rents in those units. It's also true for people, elderly folks who are all on Social Security benefits, who on average are bringing in about $1,300 a month. They also cannot find a unit they can afford or even pay for in our market. And even our full-time and minimum wage workers are struggling. You can see that they may be able to pay the rent, but they are going to be severely rent burdened. And when we continue to have that situation, when there continues to be a growing and very large disparity between what our lowest income households have available to them in income and what it costs to rent, this quote you have here is from a McKinsey study that was done in Seattle recently, but it applies here just the same. People become homeless because every day tens of thousands of households are on the verge, and it doesn't take very much for something to happen that will put folks onto the streets. There is no stronger correlation than the correlation between the increase in rents and rates of homelessness. So with that, I will turn it over to our Deputy Director, Patricia. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Well, I have the pleasure of sharing data with you that shows that your strong leadership and your commitment to collective effort is paying off. It is leading to big strides in ending homelessness in our community, and we also have a lot of work to do. We in the Joint Office had made significant improvements over the last couple of years in how we talk about data, how we gather data, how we analyze data. And that being said, there is also a lot of work to do there. With every question that is answered by data, there is another that emerges. And the Joint Office is committed to constantly improving our process of data analysis. And then one last thing before I jump into the first slide is that data conversation is very important to keeping ourselves accountable. And today, for the sake of the vast amount of information that we're going to provide, I will not have a ton of time to cover data, but I will welcome one-on-ones and will provide a significant report that provides a lot of detail to answer more questions. All right, so we'll jump right in to placements into permanent housing. Oh, sorry, before we jump into that, sorry, I forgot about this slide. So a big number here. We have served 35,000 people in FY18, and that is a significant number of folks across the various systems that are part of our efforts. And just for context, the city of Forest Grove, I think, is at 24,000, and Fairview is around 7. So there's a lot of folks that are benefiting from the collective effort that we have here. So now we're looking at folks served into or placed into permanent housing. Notably, we've had an increase over the last several years in folks being placed into permanent housing. And if we really look back into before for everyone, that number is nearly double. And this year, or FY18, we reached 5,924 new placements. And because of our improved data capacity, we're also able to reflect folks that we're still serving from the previous year. And that number has also increased significantly to 11,990 individuals. As Mark mentioned earlier, we have a commitment to racial equity. And we can't address equity if we don't know the extent of the inequities that exist in our communities. And so one of the things that we have taken a stride towards is the disaggregation of data and how data is the definitions of race. So you'll see a much broader range of definitions or categories for race. And for example, this is very important because in certain categories that as defined by HUD, which is the previous way that we defined race, for example, in the Latinx community, you don't really get to see race in its true form. Some people have to mark white or other, and so it doesn't give us a clear picture of what the disparities are in communities of color. And so a big shout out to Steve for doing this because it's great. So that being said, we have the point in time outlined at the bottom. And this is important because the way we address racial inequities is by making advancement and increasing levels of services in the communities of color that are facing disparities. So we're addressing racial inequities, and you can see that by the level of the percentages of that are associated with communities of color in the point in time count are lower than the percentage of service delivery. So hopefully that makes sense. The point in time, as you may know, is our mechanism to count and talk about homelessness in our community. And it is imperfect. It has flaws both in its methodology and in its capacity to reach. One of those areas that is very difficult is that it's not an inclusive, it doesn't have inclusive definitions of homelessness. And we know that in our community, homelessness does not just express as street homelessness or shelter. In immigrant communities and Latinx community, as an example, we see folks doubled up, tripled up in unsafe situations, and that is something the point in time does not capture. So again, we have some work to do in how we are reflecting homelessness in our community. So we also have a slide here on the retention work. So we're not only placing folks, but we're also supporting folks to, once they are placed, to retain their housing. It appears from the data that we're seeing a decline in retention. And we have found a strong correlation between the rate of decline and the rate of an organization's ability to contact the individual. part of our system is that if we are not able to contact the individual a year after exiting the program, then if we're not able to contact them, we assume that they are no longer housed. That is what the data reflects, or is how it is being reflected in the data. But we don't know. And so this is an area that we need to dig a little deeper to find out what are the barriers that agencies are facing in contacting folks a year post-exit. One of the most notable things, however, is that something we're doing is working, because of the people that we were able to contact, 89% of those individuals reported being stably housed. So that's something to celebrate. So the Joint Office of Homeless Services does not procure or run the prevention part of our system. And again, it is a very important part of the strategy in ending homelessness is to stop it from happening to begin with. And this slide shows that we have placed 6,320 individuals in new prevention support for a total of 8,048 when we look at the total number of people that we've served, so those from the previous year that are still engaged in services. When we disaggregate by race, something that's notable in the data is in the Latinx community in particular, you see a significantly higher rate of folks receiving prevention services. And as, again, to my earlier comment, we know that the Latinx community and many immigrant communities do not present through the adult coordinated systems or homelessness end of the spectrum. They will present in the prevention end of the spectrum because of definition limitations. And so I think this slide points to something going on there that we need to explore further.
Madam Chair, I have a quick question on the retention. Those numbers look great, but as you say, the Latinx numbers go down by 101. And how do you propose from 17 to 18, we lost 101 folks with that, if you look at the numbers, Hispanic or Latinx. In fiscal year 17, there were 955 folks helped, but the number went down to 854, which is 101. How do we propose to make that difference up?
So I think I don't know why we lost the image up there, but folks are, you have it in front of you, so hopefully you're looking at the printed slide. So, Commissioner, you're referring to
the permanent
permanent placement or the preventions?
People served in permanent housing.
Oh, let's go back to that.
Previous slide.
Every demographic has increased from fiscal year 17 to fiscal year 18, but the Latinx numbers went down by 101.
Yeah.
Are we trying to identify how that happened?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, again, as I mentioned in the beginning, there's going to be a lot of questions that will emerge from the data, and we've made a commitment to continue to explore those answers. That being said, there are a lot, what the data doesn't tell you is what's happening in the environment. And one of the things, honestly, as a person that lives in the community, in the Latinx community, and that worked in this service area, one of the things that we've seen is that folks don't want to engage right now with government institutions. And so that's just a reality, is that there are factors in the landscape that people don't want to be seen. And that plays in. And so again, we want to consider that there's a lot that we don't know about the reasons why we're seeing what we're doing, like why we're seeing some of these rates be what they are. And we have a lot of digging to do with our communities to figure out in more detail what's leading to that.
So are you saying these folks are service resistors?
No, not necessarily. I'm just saying as an example, there are factors in the environment that may lead to a person's, a person's situation, or the rate being what it is. Does that make sense?
Or they may have lost their housing for whatever reason.
There's a big question mark. We don't know. And so it could be that, you know, in terms of retention, somebody may be working three jobs and not able to pick up a call, you know, as far as our ability to reach people, you know, as an example. So there are lots of areas that we have to research to figure out more specifically what is happening there.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, we'll continue.
Okay, I think we were on the next slide.
This is the retention for the prevention.
Oh, perfect. So thank you. So similarly, a similar factor here. If an agency isn't able to make contact with a household, then we can't verify what is happening, and we are having challenges contacting folks. The other piece that I think is in line with what I was mentioning earlier is, you know, the political environment does pose a significant challenge to communities of color. And there are situations where organizations are having to mitigate a significant level of trauma in delivering the services that are being delivered. And that impacts an organization's ability to deliver the service. And so we have to balance making sure that we're supporting organizations to do trauma-informed work and use culturally specific and responsive approaches in a meaningful way. And so some of those numbers have been reduced because of that. And so to recognize the level of trauma, and also as systems expand and scale, there will also be a lull in time as the system is building. And so again, there are lots of questions that have emerged from the numbers that we're seeing, but we are going to continue to dig in deeper into what's going on there. But those are some examples of factors that come into play.
Have the methods of trying to contact people changed since over the course of time? So it seems like that would be a stable factor, so that wouldn't necessarily account for the decreases.
And feel free to jump in, Mark. Each organization uses mechanisms. So calling is one mechanism, but I will also say that organizations use whatever mechanism best works in their communities. And so they know their communities best in their engagement practices. And so I would say that there is a variation of techniques to try and contact individuals. So there is some digging to do around what retention or what those efforts look like.
I think it's important, and Patricia mentioned this, that this is trying to contact folks who are no longer enrolled in services. So they've been out of services for a year. Mm-hmm. We, of course, are in close touch. The providers are close in touch with folks when they're enrolled. But we measure retention to see were the interventions, the services provided, effective in generating longer-term stability. So it's contacting somebody who we may not have been in contact with for 6 months or 12 months, and that presents part of the challenge. But I don't think the methods have changed much. We have a lot more people trying to be contacted now than we used to, and providers are having to scale up. So we are, as Patricia said, looking into understanding better what's going on there. Okay. Emergency shelter.
Yep. Right. Another component of our strategy is emergency shelter. And we have served over 8,000 folks in shelter, which is a lower number than the year before. And I think what's a very important factor in that statistic is the fact that shelter stays are longer. They're basically double the rate they were last year. And so what's really an important message is that if people don't have a place to move to from shelter, then we can't serve as many people. So even though we've added capacity to shelter, it's still an issue because of the housing crisis. Okay, and so all that being said, there is still a significant need. We're doing a lot of great work. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, and we know that there is a significant need out there, and we need to expand all parts of our system. We need to continue to build what we've started to build. This slide is an example of
just one snapshot. It is not. This is by no means a comprehensive reflection of what the need is in our community. These are the two entry points to our system. So the top number is the list of folks waiting on our adult coordinated access, and the bottom number is for the family system, folks waiting in the queue. And so, again, without supportive housing, we're not going to be able to address the issues, and we're not going to be able to be as effective or optimal in each of the service areas that we provide. So I'm going to pass it on to Mark now to talk a little bit further about that piece of this structure.
And I'm actually going to hand it on to Commissioner Fish, but I do want to set the context for us. I mean, we've, as you heard, there's been a lot of activity inside of the joint office, but one of the most important things we've been involved with was initially the framing of a plan around chronic homelessness, and the center point of that was supportive housing. And for the last 9 months, at your direction, we've had the opportunity to work on this supportive housing plan. And with that, I'll give it to Commissioner Fish, who can introduce our next presenter.
Thank you very much, and let me join with the mayor in welcoming our colleagues from the other side of the river. I think I speak for all my colleagues that I wish we had more opportunities like this to visit and to have these conversations, because there's a lot of learning going on. So thank you, Mark. And colleagues, let me begin by saying I've been commissioner long enough to remember when we didn't have a Portland Housing Bureau or a joint office of homeless services. Instead, affordable housing was divided between the Portland Development Commission and the former Bureau of Housing and Community Development. And we had a disparate system of services and facilities spanning two governments with many disconnected pieces of the puzzle. At a certain point, we realized that structural problems were getting in the way of doing this work as efficiently and as effectively as we could, and that vulnerable people in our community deserve better. So in 2009, we created the Portland Housing Bureau to focus on the needs of our community's most vulnerable. That left the then Portland Development Commission to focus on economic development, and PHB to focus on homelessness and affordable housing. Next, under the leadership of Chair Kafoury and Commissioner Saltzman, we undertook a major review of our homeless service system and determined that collapsing the work of the county and the city into one office, governed by both jurisdictions, was the best solution. Now, it didn't happen overnight, and a lot of us had heartburn about pieces of this transition, but we shared the ultimate vision of a joint office, and we worked together to implement the vision. Today, I'm proud to report we have a more streamlined and effective structure that allows us to do the most good for the most people with our limited resources. And our commitment to this work isn't dependent on the commitment of any single elected official at the city or the county. The joint office ensures that each and every one of us prioritizes this work. So why am I telling you this? I love these rhetorical questions. I think Sonia put that in. So why am I telling you this? Because I believe we're at a similar juncture with our work on supportive housing. We've all been at this long enough to understand that supportive housing is the solution to reducing chronic homelessness. The most recent point in time count showed that nearly 3/4 of people living outside are chronically homeless. That means they're dealing with things like chronic illness, drug and alcohol addiction, and or mental health challenges, or all three. In short, they're the people most at risk of dying on our streets. They need the most help, and they require the most public investment to achieve safe and stable housing. That's why in 2017, the city and the county made a big commitment to add 2,000 new units of supportive housing over the next 10 years. And while I'm pleased that we're making good progress to add the new housing to our system, we also know that we don't have a structure in place that will allow us to create supportive housing at scale as efficiently and as effectively as we would like. So last year, we asked the joint office to lead the work of building a plan to scale up these investments, to get many more units online, and to establish a system that can continue to produce supportive housing until we're meeting our community's need. Today, our partners at the Corporation for Supportive Housing and the joint office will give us a roadmap, and they will share with us what they believe it will take to get to our shared goal. I'm really proud of this work, and I'm looking forward to hearing from them. But I want to close with a cautionary note. Supportive housing is a significant investment in our future. Failure to invest in solutions to ending chronic homelessness will cost us even more. So So I'm pleased to hand it off to Interim Director of the Portland Housing Bureau, Shannon Callahan. Shannon?
Good afternoon, Commissioner Fish and members of the County Commission. I am actually, believe I'm turning it over to Heather Lyons this morning to kick us off. Heather, would you like to?
Yeah. Yeah, thank
you. Heather has been working with us since the advent of the county and city resolution with the and presents to us the plan that has been developed in coordination with the city and the county joint office, Portland Housing Bureau, and a numerous list of partners in the nonprofit and affordable housing development community. So with that, thank you very much, Heather.
Okay, thank you, Shannon. Good afternoon, Mayor, Chair, and Commissioners. My name is Heather Lyons, and I'm the Director of the Pacific Northwest, Hawaii, Alaska, and Northern California for CSH. I'm here to highlight the report regarding the recommendations for the 2,000 new units of supportive housing. And while my work covers a large geographic area, I've been spending most of my time doing work in Portland and Multnomah County, and I live here, so I'm really thrilled to be doing work in my backyard. CSH, or the, I'm not sure the slides are, oh well. There they go. Thank you. CSH, or the Corporation for Supportive Housing, is a national organization represented in all regions across the United States. We've been around for more than 25 years. We started our work in New York, and that's where our headquarters are now. Our primary focus is to create supportive housing through systems and policy change and, of course, increased resources. The presentation you're going to see is follows the outline of the report that you've received. So I'm going to start with a background, and it's going to be pretty brief because I think both Commissioner Fish and Mark and Patricia have talked a little bit about the population we're going to be talking about today. So first, what is supportive housing? We at CSH, we believe that deeply affordable housing is the solution to ending all homelessness, and that supportive housing is the solution for a subset of people who need both affordable housing and coordinated services to succeed in that housing. And not everybody, I'm sorry that the font is so small, but hopefully you can read it on your handout a little bit. Not everyone experiencing homelessness needs supportive housing. Here are some characteristics of those who do. They have very, very low incomes. They have complex needs. They are chronically homeless and or cycle through institutions. Prospective tenants of supportive housing are also often those individuals and, sadly, some families that we see on sidewalks, parks, and other public areas of our community. It works. We have a huge evidence base that shows that it works, and there's just a few examples on this slide, including a study of Bud Clark Commons here in Portland, Oregon. It works not only for improving health outcomes and housing outcomes for people, but it also decreased costs in the community, which Mayor Wheeler alluded to. Excuse me. More detail about these and others are in the report, including a link to CSH's extensive bibliography outlining research across many communities, projects, and systems. During this whole process, we applied a Home for Everyone's racial equity statement and related work with SPARC to all aspects of this planning effort. These will be especially important and, frankly, could be updated through the implementation effort in order to be explicit about the needs for people of color who need supportive housing. Additionally, a Home for Everyone has used a racial equity lens for the definition of chronic homelessness, and I'm so glad, because the definition of chronic homelessness does not serve communities of color very well. So a Home for Everyone it changed that definition to better meet the needs of people of color, and we applied this in our work through this process as well. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about our analysis of the unit projections and the financial modeling. There are essentially four models of supportive housing. These are explained in detail in the report. Single site means all units are supportive housing in a single building. Integrated means that some units of an affordable property may be set aside for supportive housing. Scattered site units are leased units in the community. Some may be clustered, which is a fourth type in a rental development, meaning you could have 12 or 13 or 14 units in a larger unit, which actually helps save resources in terms of serving populations and also can help build community.
excuse me. So while these are very simple diagrams of two types of financing that we modeled, the approach for both, as most people who are sitting in this room, is quite complicated. Thankfully, the city, county, Home Forward, and very excellent providers in the community have the brains and experience to make that happen. There are pros and cons to both approaches. For leasing units, some of these pros and cons may be relatively obvious. Two very important pros are that it's much more expedient and increases tenant choice to do leasing in the community. However, as most people know and as Mark described in his presentation, the market is tightening, and Multnomah County has consistently been losing units at 30% and below of median family income, thereby increasing the amount of rent assistance that is needed. Also, when we double what's called double subsidizing through rent assistance, particularly in some affordable housing, we increase the risk to reduce the total availability of affordable housing, which can disproportionately affect people of color, and this really needs to be paid attention to. So therefore, what's critically important is that the overall policy is to create a net gain of affordable and supportive housing units. So for building new units, the pros and cons may also be a little bit obvious. Building creates new stock that is more secure than leasing in the community, and it creates jobs, and the configuration can build a sense of community among tenants. All of that is wonderful. However, it takes a very long time to develop units in the community. The cost is also greater in the beginning, but as you'll see in the next slide, the annual cost actually goes down. We offer two models for consideration. One is a 50-50 build-to-lease model, 50 units built in the community or developed in the community. That also includes rehab. And 50 units leased in the community. The other model is a 70-30 model build-to-lease. The 70-30 model is more expensive in the beginning, as it makes sense, because you're developing 70% of the units in the community. It ends up being more cost-effective in the long run when it comes to ongoing costs. As you'll see in the last columns, the annual costs are $43 million a year versus $47 million a year. Also, over time, savings in operations of developed units versus leasing in the community actually makes up for capital expenses. And more information about how all of this works is detailed out in the report. These costs are based on the 2,000-unit goal. In the report, you'll see we actually estimate the need over 10 years to be 2,455. We used point-in-time data that we annualized along with some formulas that CSH has developed over time to get to a number that not only includes chronically homeless people, but includes other people who may not meet the definition of chronic homelessness for whatever reason, and often are folks who are cycling through our emergency service centers and our institutions. Particularly, more detail on population characteristics are in your report and especially in Appendix E. So there is a cost of not doing it, as Mayor Wheeler mentioned. These are local costs, and the sources of these costs are in the report. As I mentioned in the last slide, many potential tenants of supportive housing cycle through emergency and institutional settings. And if any of you have been through an emergency department waiting room, you can witness the extent of this use for yourself. As you can see, supportive housing is significantly less expensive. And additionally, research documents that it improves health outcomes and it reduces criminality of people who are cycling through these institutions once they are placed in supportive housing. So now how do we get all of this funded? It will clearly take more than the city and county resources to get to 2,000 units and Home Forward as well. These notable examples on the slide include health systems who engaged a team of us to create a strategic plan to help them determine how to explore investments in supportive housing, which is exciting. These include mechanisms to pool resources regionally. Also, private insurance has been involved heavily in funding supportive housing in other states, and we've been doing a lot of work with them in communities across the country. That hasn't happened yet here in Oregon, and there may be an opportunity there. Finally, you may have seen the governor released her housing agenda, and increasing permanent supportive housing for those experiencing chronic homelessness is in one of her top four categories. So the state is definitely paying attention to this. And I should also note that many of these sources, including
philanthropy have been at the table for some time. And in short, there's a lot of interest in supportive housing, just a lot of interest as a solution to systems problems, which provides great opportunities for engagement. This is one model that I'd like to share that we have been involved in at CSH. The Flexible Housing Subsidy Pool, or FHSP, is a model that's currently being employed at a very large scale in Los Angeles. It was first developed in San Francisco, and a new effort is underway in Chicago. This is a method for pooling resources administered usually by one entity, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. While the title includes housing subsidy, it can also fund services and has the potential to include capital resources as well. It also gives opportunities for new funding entities to more easily invest in supportive housing as a solution to people experiencing long-term homelessness with complex health needs. There's also some... I want to go through... there's a lot going on around supportive housing in the community, and I want to go through a couple of the related efforts. There is a tri-county plan that's currently happening that's funded by Metro. We're currently working on a ground-up process in Washington and Clackamas counties to encourage leadership to identify supportive housing as a key solution to their issues around homelessness, and the Multnomah County report will be included in this. The mental health analysis, spearheaded by Commissioner Mirren, was released in June, and the report outlines funding and services that can help guide opportunities to integrate community services for people living in supportive housing. The Regional Supportive Housing Impact Fund, or RSHIF, collaborative is the offshoot of the Health Systems and Foundation's investment of $22.6 million for Central City Concerned Buildings. And as I mentioned before, they are interested in future investments, and they're funding a few of us to help come up with a strategic plan to help them figure out how best to do that. The last thing I'll mention is the Frequent User Systems Engagement effort, FUSE. The purpose of it is to identify frequent users across systems, and these are highly vulnerable people who are cycling through these systems. Multnomah County FUSE includes criminal justice, health systems, and the homeless sector, and it also includes Unity. In addition to identifying this issue, these individuals, the process promotes systems collaboration as well as works to get these identified study into supportive housing. So it's more than just a research piece. It's actually about ending homelessness for these folks who are cycling through the institutions. So, on to implementation. As with any new governance model, there are new acronyms. So, allow me to introduce the SHFC and the SHIC. The Supportive Housing Funders Collaborative will work on obtaining new or expanded revenue to fund supportive housing. The Implementation Committee will refine recommendations in the plan as needed, track projects against the progress metrics, and provide regular reports to A Home for Everyone and other community-facing bodies. These groups will work with the Home for Everyone subcommittees and will also fall under the Executive Committee. Having this structure is critical to sustained implementation to create 2,000 units and more. What we've seen in many communities is that there may be great political will, there may be great community advocacy, but if you don't have the support within the bureaucracy and within the community to have the infrastructure, it just doesn't happen. So this is really important to have in place. There's more detailed descriptions of these bodies and the potential membership in your report, but they are intended to be designed with cross-systems membership and also using a well-thought-out equity lens for supportive housing. The plan also suggests a regional model that's similar in scope to the local model. It's a really great suggestion and something we plan to offer to the steering committee of the Tri-County planning effort that I mentioned earlier. Additionally, the Regional Supportive Housing Impact Fund Collaborative Strategic Plan is also region-wide. So it's really important to focus on our region when it comes to efforts of supportive housing. Here's some recommended outcomes to be tracked. In addition to these, other funders who come to the table may want to see improved health outcomes for tenants in addition to housing retention. While it's in a smaller font, it is really, really important to state that the data sharing is critical for measuring this effort as well as related ones, including FUSE and the Regional Supportive Housing Impact Fund. It's a very difficult process, but it's absolutely necessary to better understand the needs of the population, and it helps systems figure out how to work better together. The final component of implementation is to ensure that a communication plan is completed in order to make sure the public understands the importance of the investment as well as the outcomes in people's lives. An example would be Speak Up, which is a program in Los Angeles that CSH supports and in Chicago as well. It helps supportive housing tenants find their voice, tell their story, and learn how to be strong advocates in the community. And while it's very easy to get caught up in these numbers, and we should certainly talk about them, we all recognize that the point of doing this work is for the people. Supportive housing has worked for so many and can work for so many more. There's a saying in mindfulness practice that says, may all beings find relief, may all beings find peace, and may all beings be at ease. And supportive housing offers that venue for people in need. First, thank you all for your leadership, for even sitting around the table together and listening to us talk with you around these issues around homelessness and supportive housing. In addition to everyone that's listed in Appendix A when you get to that part of the report, thanks to your staff, thanks to the conveners, the provider advisory group, and others who've been absolutely critical in the process. I also want to call out the support and expertise from staff in the joint office, Mark for sure, but especially Ryan Dybert. He was absolutely essential in helping to pull this report together. I also want to recognize this group of folks called the PSH Group, who was a subcommittee of the Home for Everyone's Health and Housing Committee. And this small group of people that you probably have never heard of helped spark this first level of work that got us to this point. And while the whole group contributed to jump-starting the effort, I just want to call out those of you may know or may not know, you should know, Amanda Saul. Really, she staffed that, she kept us together, and she kept it organized, and she really made a lot of this happen. And now that we're at this point, it's worth highlighting nationally how this community is exploring how to bring various resources to the table in creating systems change. This can't be done without the infrastructure and the work that has already gone into creating a home for everyone, and this shows that the community can come together to accomplish these goals. And finally, one thing that's really exciting about this that is always exciting to see this, that implementation starts before the planning is done. Units are actually going on the ground, which you'll hear about in a minute. It is trend-setting work to have this level of momentum, and as I stated, CSH does this kind of work all over the country. And Portland and Multnomah County are considered a leader among others in this movement. And fair warning, we should expect a lot of visitors from a lot of other communities to learn how we do it. So now I'll turn it back to Mark and Shannon, as well as to Michael Bonacardi. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Goes to you.
Okay, great. So although 2,000 units of supportive housing is really an ambitious goal, one of the reasons we're really confident that we can reach that goal is because of the progress that we've already been able to achieve working together. Since the adoption of the resolution that you passed in October of last year, we have added or planned in our pipeline 517 units of new supportive housing. The latest of those projects you will learn about at the end of this presentation from Chair Kefouri and Mayor Wheeler. 162 of the units are already online through a combination of acquisition and long-term leasing. I have details on where all those projects are located, and they will be in our State of Housing report later this year. Commissioner Fish, I wanted to make sure you were aware of that we'll make sure to have it in State of Housing very shortly. Another 355 units are already planned and in our pipeline and will be online by 2021. 280 of those are new construction acquisition. Primarily, those are some of the units we already had in our pipeline and then new housing bond units that we're planning for. Which include the project you'll hear about this afternoon, as well as our 30th and Powell project and our project that we're beginning construction on in the Cully neighborhood. 75 of those units are will be leased in existing units with the support of VASH vouchers. Home Forward really plays a central role in both of these strategies, both the leasing and the building and acquisition of new units. So this is our way of making sure that there's a very clear and transparent way of communicating our progress to the public. So this you'll see, which we will be constantly updating, is just one of the simplest forms of updates that you'll see from us. There's other tracking methods that Heather indicated earlier in her proposal, but this is something that we think will resonate and be easily able to explain to the public as to where we are in terms of our progress. And one of the more exciting pipeline projects that we've been able to coordinate on is actually in the Summer Notice of Funds Availability, or NOFA. It's a way that Portland Housing Bureau puts out funds in a competitive process. We are presently soliciting proposals for that to create the first new supportive housing